are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, February 14th, 2019. I'm Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Professor Gene Bajelon of Missouri State University. We're talking about the looming threat as the Warsaw Conference on Iran continues. Bibi's talking about war with Iran as a crazed foreign ministries and prime ministers and leadership of Israel and the Gulf states make increasingly ominous noises. And Netanyahu takes credit for airstrikes in Syria. Europeans fighting to maintain the Iran deal as the U.S., Israeli, Emirati Gulf, and Saudi axis seems to be pushing for global catastrophe. We'll talk about that with him. Plus, an update on Kurdistan. The leaders of the most promising political party in Turkey, political prisoners under Erdogan. We'll be talking about that with Professor Bajelon. Ilhan Omar is an absolute rock star. Let's go into some of the history of just what crimes Elliot Abrams was doing. And of course, we'll only be covering a fraction of them. There's a whole world to lay to waste with that absolute ghoul and the absolute ghouls that he represented. Then we'll talk about the less significant but also ghoulish chumps saying, like, you know, it's super rude to talk about supporting genocide. He's very nice in the coffee room. New York City wins. The Amazon scam is canceled. Organizing works, folks.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye. Thank you. Many people are saying it. Good time as any to knock on some doors and make some contributions to Nomiki Konst, her great campaign for New York City public advocate and her advocacy. Part of the effort against canceling that nonsense. The House passes a measure to stop U.S. support for the slaughter in Yemen. However, there is a significant caveat that was put in there that might dilute the effect of that legislation. Paul Manafort admits, oh, he lied. And Cuba suggests that U.S. is moving planes in a strategic fashion towards escalating even more as they continue to choreograph this attempted coup in Venezuela. Natural catastrophe in Zimbabwe as anti-austerity protests continue there, similar to the ones in the Sudan. Ruth Bader Ginsburg isn't looking to quit, but Judge Clarence Thomas, who should have been removed quite some time ago from the court, is considering doing just that. Potential new ludicrous charges against political prisoner Lula da Silva in Brazil as Brazilian defense forces move in and engage in indiscriminate killings in favelas, and NRA-style gun laws are unleashed on Brazil. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. So, folks, I want to say we all saw the incredible Ilhan Omar clip with Elliot Abrams. It's embargoed, and actually Sam did have a legit defense. He said, look, I've been hating Elliot Abrams since you were in diapers, and fair enough. We're going to – not only actually are we going to play the clip tomorrow, but there's actually going to be a good interview specifically on the just – literally endless crimes and just complete inhumanity of the relentlessly grotesque Elliot Abrams and the relentless grotesqueness in U.S. foreign policy, defense, intellectual, and diplomatic establishments that he represents, as well as this just like bizarre toadying defense of a guy who, you know, at the very least should be disgraced, if not in prison. So we'll get to that. But we're going to go in the second half on some of the specific histories of El Salvador and Guatemala. But we just want to sort of give you a teaser in this opening segment here. Because first, here's Ilhan Omar. And I just got to say, I did an analysis of it. People should check out at the Michael Brooks Show YouTube page on the freak out about her Israel statements. And, you know, I think there's actually subtleties and nuances to get into here, including a critique of outrage culture, frankly, as well as also the fact that everybody can, you know, improve. God's working on all of us, as Desus and Mero say. But the bottom line is, as on the substance of Israel as a policy question, she is 100% right in terms of the abuse of Palestinians. And she has also been a target of right-wing political terrorism, including from fellow members of Congress, and now, of course, the idiot, dope, bigot-in-chief president. The fact that she would have the chutzpah, and I will teach her that if she doesn't know that Yiddish word yet, the chutzpah to come out and just give this pure moral clarity and acuity in that exchange with the disgusting, grotesque Elliot Abrams. I mean, people should go hit her with a campaign contribution. I mean, this is just incredibly impressive leadership. Ilhan Omar is a hero. And I also enjoyed this because, look, she released the statement. It was actually a great statement. She pulled off an incredible synthesis of expressing sensitivity to where people had felt she had gone wrong and also reaffirming her commitment to working on the underlying issue, which she's 100% right about with regards to democracy for all in the Middle East. CNN is still trying to make an issue of it, and she was confronted walking the halls of Congress by Manu Raju. And instead of saying, like, hey, have you always cared so passionately about the genocide in Guatemala, which Elliot Abrams supported, the cover-ups of the mass rapes and beheadings of toddlers in El Salvador, which he supported and covered up? How was it? How about the blowback from a bunch of people who apparently think, you know, having coffee in a think tank boardroom is more important than genocide? What about that? No, they go back to this already dead story that the political right is trying to make hay of, and she shows that she, AOC is not the only one that knows how to handle public nuisances.
Our own Manu Raju found her quite unwilling to discuss the controversy.
Oh, shut
when
up.
He asked
Pause,
her about
I'm sorry.
It.
Just as always, Jake Tapper, shut up.
Jake Tapper on brand here, pestering a Muslim.
Pestering a Muslim with his concern, like this piety nonsense of Jake Tapper. Just shut up. All right, go ahead.
Discuss the controversy when he asked her about it today.
The president traffic in here.
What's wrong with you?
Well, I'm asking you a question about your tweet. You had a tweet saying the president trafficked in Haiti.
Yes, I tweeted. There's a response. You can run that. Have a nice day.
They leave out the critical part where he's asking her about Trump's tweet in response to her response.
What about your tweet, though?
What about your tweet to my tweet? What about that's
no, right. Not your original tweet. What about your reply to
what about your reply tweet, which got ratioed? Actually, didn't it all get ratioed at one? But great crack reporting. Instead of, you know, go back and read Manufacturing Consent by Noam Chomsky. There's no doubt that the, you know, corporate press has, of course, always been, you know, kowtowed to the U.S. foreign policy establishment. But like, we're still going to play a throwback clip of the 1980s of Peter Jennings talking about the mass murder that the Reagan administration backed in El Salvador. And in 2019, CNN is like, you know what? Don't even worry about the Guatemala genocide stuff. Let's go try to talk about her Twitter drama with Trump. Pathetic.
You said give money to Ilhan.
Yes, indeed.
Jesse Kelly here, if you want to put that up, Brendan. Who's apparently, I think, a Republican. What does he say here? The Jesse Kelly
he's
show.
The kid. He's the guy who was really upset that his kid was doing a robotics competition. He was talking about getting drunk all weekend. embarrassed by his son who does robotics competition.
Yeah. My son's a nerd.
So Jesse says Republicans should be pouring money into Ilhan Omar's reelection campaign. If you're a Republican and you wanted to plant a destructive parasite, I mean, that's some interesting language
that's,
there.
That's I was going to say. That's an interesting. And actually, if you think of, well, this doesn't apply because she's Muslim, she's not Arab. But if we expanded Semite to include Arabs at least, the phrase parasite in relation to any Semitic people. I'm going to say
not,
pretty strong.
Not good.
Not skillful.
What exactly would you be doing differently than what she's doing? It's glorious. I'm donating. Please, Republicans, please, yeah. Please donate to Ilhan Omar.
You are totally right. Actually, as a matter of fact,
you're owning the libs.
Yes. Every time a Republican donates money to Ilhan Omar, a transgender equal civil rights bathroom is closed or something. I don't know. We cry liberal tears. Don't do it. Republicans, don't send money to Ilhan Omar.
Or a unisex bathroom will be segregated again.
Yeah. Oh, no, please don't. I guess it probably is pretty easy to do reverse psychology in these idiots. But no, I mean, don't listen to Jesse Kelly. Oh, no. If you're a Republican, don't contribute money to Ilhan Omar. Okay. And I just want a couple, as I say, foreshadowing, because we're going to go more into depth in terms of Guatemala and El Salvador. And then, you know, tomorrow with Elliot Abrams. I mean, there's a whole world to lay to waste with this guy and all, you know, obviously U.S. foreign policy that he represents. I've kind of had a soft spot for Kilmeade recently. And I mean, you know, just in the sense that occasionally he seems to not, you know, he's sort of been caught up to like 2002 in terms of like overt racism.
And he can have instinctively human responses, which are normally conditioned out of Fox News.
Right, which you'll never see from a Ducey. But look, it's Fox and Friends. They're stupid. They're immoral. They don't know anything. I just want, as a foreshadowing, just to be really clear, when we talk about like what the Reagan administration backed in El Salvador in the 80s as an example, we're not talking about, you know, like, I don't know what they mean. Maybe it's almost like you're trying to conjure almost like a Singapore image. Like, oh, you know, like Lee Kuan Yew had to arrest. And by the way, this is wrong, too. But it's you're conjuring an image of like, oh, well, you know, you put some people in jail. You shut down some newspapers, which, by the way, should be unacceptable in and of itself. But just to be really clear here, there are documented cases of El Salvadoran soldiers going into a family's home, beheading everybody, and then doing it around a table so that the heads are reattached to the body with oh no hands on their faces and a bowl of blood in the middle of the table. I mean, you're talking about the types of things that honestly, I mean, I guess if you were looking, some persons have said ISIS would be similar. That's true. And then some stuff that you would see in the cartel wars was the governments that the Reagan administration was not only financially and politically, but like morally backing, like greeting in the White House. And there were endless contemporaneous reports of what was happening. And Elliot Abrams was going, I don't think that's true. So just to be clear here, as we laugh at the, you know, in this case, as dumb as he is, just totally immoral, Brian Kilmeade, keep that in mind.
She's Question. Accusing him of being a liar and wanted to know about the Iran-Contra affair.
He is a liar.
In El Salvador, in Nicaragua, in that region, Bolivia, there was a communist infiltration in the 1980s. And President Reagan wasn't going to have it. He was going to make sure that the Russians and then the Soviets were not going to infiltrate and take over our hemisphere. So to do that, you had to do some extreme work. He's part of that work. And the efforts of that gave us El Salvador, which is closer to a democracy than not, right. And Central and South America the president right. should be very proud of his foreign policy. For this refreshment congresswoman yeah. to be that dismissive and condescending to someone like Elliot Abrams is beyond the pale. Democrats should all be embarrassed.
Yeah, we should really be embarrassed. First of all, he was a liar. He was literally pardoned for his role in Iran-Contra. That's on the public record. I know obviously there's no research staff there. And then, I mean, again, extreme work, as he sounds like the general character in Doctor Strange.
That is an amazing on-the-fly euphemism. Like,
I mean,
very revealing.
Orwellian's overused, but what other word could you use to describe that? I mean, I thought collateral damage was a cynical evasion of a profoundly ugly truth. Extreme work? I mean, this, what is this, like a new, like, what is, like, Kilmeade's new regimen at the Equinox? I mean, wow. Beyond disgusting. All right, we're going to take a little bit of a break, and we will be right back with Gene Bajelan. If you're listening on podcast, you had a very good interstitial there. Joining us now is Gene Bajelan. He's a professor at Missouri State University. He's also a regular on TMBS. Gene, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Great to have you on. So the war drums coming out of Warsaw are extraordinarily disturbing. I mean, we'll get into the particulars of the implications of pulling out of the Iran deal, the various regional dynamics at play. But the rhetoric, particularly from Netanyahu, literally using the word war, should make everybody obviously not only profoundly concerned, but yet to organizing against the catastrophe that apparently he and Pompeo and the Gulf states are pushing. I want to also just start us off here by saying that Benjamin Netanyahu has a pretty long history of talking about military interventions in the Middle East spearheaded by the United States that will work out quite well, in his estimation. This is a clip from 2002 where Benjamin Netanyahu, in testimony before the U.S. Congress, suggests that not only, and this is really important, not only that invading Iraq will be great, but that invading Iraq is the only path to peace in the Middle East. And think of, and Mike Pompeo said this just yesterday with regards to Iran. This is Bibi Netanyahu in 2002.
If you take out Saddam's regime, I guarantee you that it will have enormous positive reverberations on the region. And I think that people sitting right next door in Iran, young people, and many others will say, the time of such regimes, of such despots, is gone. There is a new age. Something new is happening.
And that Iraq, is speculation on your part, or you have some evidence to that effect?
I was asked the same question in 1986. I had written a book in which I had said that the way to deal with terrorist regimes, well, with terror, was to deal with the terrorist regimes. And the way to deal with the terrorist regimes, among other things, was to apply military force against them.
The way we did in Afghanistan.
The way, for example, I want to answer your question.
Well, I guess I'm running out of time, so I quickly was trying to get there. We've done, I think, what you proposed in Afghanistan, yet I haven't seen that sort of neighborhood effect.
Well, I think there's been an enormous effect. The effect was, we were told that there would be a contrary effect. First of all, people said that there would be tens of thousands of people streaming into Afghanistan, zealots who would be outraged by America's action, and this would produce a counter-reaction in the Arab world.
But I think you're saying that when you take an action like we did in Afghanistan, we're going to see all the other countries just fold.
No, what we saw is something else. First of all, we saw everybody streaming out of Afghanistan. The second thing we saw is all the Arab countries and many Muslim countries trying to side with America, trying to make, to be okay with America. The application of power is the most important thing in winning the war on terrorism. If I had to say, what are the three principles of winning the war on terror, it's like, what are the three principles of real estate, the three L's, location, location, location? The three principles of winning the war on terror are the three W's, winning, winning, and winning. The more victories you amass, the easier the next victory becomes. The first victory in Afghanistan makes a second victory in Iraq that much easier. The second victory in Iraq will make the third victory that much easier too, but it may change the nature of achieving that victory. It may be possible to have implosions taking place. I don't guarantee it, Mr. Turney, but I think it makes it more likely, and therefore I think the choice of Iraq is a good...
Okay, so in addition to the fact that Benjamin Netanyahu is some form of neo-fascist, not being news to anybody with this 2002 clip, just spell out all the ways in which he was so arrogantly and catastrophically wrong there.
Well, I think you can look at that statement within the context of, judging the Iraq invasion on the metrics that people like Bibi Netanyahu and people in the Bush administration put up for them. And it's been a failure even in their terms. So, for example, we're going to be talking about Iran and the growing influence of Iran. Well, if we look at what the Iraq invasion did, it's enhanced the Iranian position in Iraq to sort of a massive degree. Now you have sort of a pro-Iranian government in Baghdad. That's not to say the Iraqi government is a tool of Iran, but Iranian influence in Iraq has increased since the Iraqi invasion. So even by their own metrics, it's really hard to argue that the Iraq war was a success. Today, Iranian backed militias are, the popular mobilization units are part of the Iraqi administration. And in fact, Iran and the United States, even under Trump, have been cooperating in the fight against ISIS in Iraq. So, even judged by sort of what Bibi Netanyahu was obviously pushing
but broaden it out. I mean, that's true, but broaden it out for just the broader humanitarian security. I mean, this is just because, again, it would have been wrong thing to do even if it was a quote-unquote success. So, yes, it failed even by their own metrics, but this was massively catastrophic and, well beyond a sort of natural relationship between Iraq and Iran.
Well, what we've seen basically is, Al-Qaeda today are kind of forgotten. We all think about ISIS. But if you remember 10, 15 years ago, Al-Qaeda was apparently the scariest thing on the block. But, we ended up with something worse. And that's ISIS, which has metastasized within the context of state collapse in Iraq, a complete failure after the invasion, sort of, and an invasion that was ill-conceived in the first place, which didn't really, there was insufficient planning and, just looking at, just the moral case for the war, it was completely unprovoked. So on an international basis, it was an example of the United States taking this preemptive action. So it's sort of and of course, the humanitarian cost for the people of Iraq and in the neighboring region has been enormous. We had mass ethnic cleansing in Iraq. There was basically a civil war taking place. Hundreds of thousands have been killed. And, it's very hard to argue that on any level that this has been a success. And the notion that this opened the way for sort of the spread of democracy in the Middle East seems a little bit absurd to me. I mean, we can't do counterfactuals. We can't go back in time and sort of check what would have happened had the United States not invaded Iraq. But, maybe the Arab Spring would have had different results. Maybe the whole discourse of democracy would have been more powerful in the Middle East. Remember, these invasions were made often in the name of promoting democracy. The Iraq War was made in the name of promoting democracy. So that, of course, leads to a great deal of suspicion in people in the Middle East regarding, democracy and the West's commitment to democracy and sort of when Western leaders sort of claim to care about these issues. People are very cynical about it. So, people are looking at Venezuela today and seeing that as almost a repeat of what was being done in Iraq, a decade and a half ago.
Right down to the U.S. manufactured opposition. Do you think that let's get to Iran. So first of all, will you spell out for us again that this whole – another part of this whole crisis is, again, the purely – I mean, Iraq was purely manufactured and lied about and hyped because Iraq simply posed no threat. It was just the notion it posed any kind of strategic systemic threat was ludicrous. In the Iran case, of course, and again, look, I don't really, in some ways, I just want to kind of put out, let's just, you know, get these other things out of the way really quickly. One, of course, does the Iranian regime have internally repressive policies? And is there a huge amount of discontent inside Iran, not only in terms of human rights, as we typically talk about here, but also, which are very important, but also labor union suppression. There's a big amount of inequality, corruption, you know. There's big problems inside Iran, and as with Iraq or Venezuela, for that matter, opposing interventions, imperialism, and war does not require spinning the performance of the government in place. Now, that being said, and then there's other areas where, you know, we have synchronized interests with Iran, or in fact, maybe we have a strong disagreement, but Iran might have a point. Other areas where Iran's role is destructive, just like any other place. But clearly, you know, Trump. You know, the United States, Israel, and Saudi Arabia are obviously in no position to talk to anybody about human rights. And more importantly than any kind of hypocrisy point, you had this incredibly effective and successful Iran nuclear deal that was working. And that's why the Europeans are still trying to preserve it. So can you walk us through the deal, the success of it, and how that's playing out in the context of this just entirely fake manufactured crisis?
Yeah, so, you know, if we go back to looking at the Iran nuclear deal in 2015, it was, you know, it set up mechanisms through which Iran's nuclear program could be verified, and it was signed by the major players, the major world powers, which includes the European Union, Russia, and China. So it was never purely a deal between the United States and Iran. It was a deal between a coalition, which the Obama administration had managed to weld together, which was no simple task, and that coalition was sort of successful in dealing with the issue of, first of all, compartmentalizing the issue of Iran's nuclear deal. There are a lot of other areas of conflict between, for example, Europe and the United States and Iran. But by compartmentalizing this particularly destabilizing issue and coming up with a mechanism which both sides could agree to. So in 2015, you have this nuclear deal being signed, you have it implemented, you have verification. And you saw a couple of weeks ago, the head of the CIA said that Iran is still technically complying with the agreement. Yep. The European Union is still trying to keep the agreement alive as well. So there's still a commitment on behalf of the other signatories to the Iran nuclear deal of keeping this agreement alive. But it was always an agreement restricted to Iran's nuclear deal. It was not billed as being a resolution to all problems between the United States and Iran. And it, you know, as a diplomatic measure, one could see it was, you know, it could have acted as building trust between the two sides and perhaps laying the foundation for a broader rapprochement. But what we saw last year was sort of Trump. The Trump administration sort of unilaterally withdrawing from that agreement. And that was particularly dangerous on a number of levels. Firstly, in terms of, again, their own stated goals of trying to sort of bring Iran under control, it removes an important sort of leverage the United States has over Iran. Now Iran enjoys the moral high ground as they remain committed to the agreement, and the United States is kind of the group that has reneged on it. It undermines broader confidence in American diplomatic activity, because of course, if you make an agreement with one administration, why would the next administration necessarily stick to that deal? So that has implications not just for the Middle East, but in other parts of the world. You know, in places like North Korea, where we desperately do need a diplomatic resolution to this crisis on the Korean Peninsula. But again, how are we going to make a plausible, how are people, leaders in the West, even let's say in 2020 you get a better president, you know, if they come to power, how can a country signing an agreement with the United States be sure that that agreement will be sort of maintained by the next administration? And that's enormously destabilizing, you know, not just for American prestige, but for stability in the world, because if the world's dominant power can't be trusted to keep to an agreement, that's, you know, obviously not something that's necessarily going to be positive for global affairs. So, you know, the chance of resolving further issues between, you know, Western powers and Iran have been diminished by this. And, you know, we still see major, you know, like, as you mentioned, and as I just mentioned, there are areas where the Iranian government and the Western powers have sort of strategic agreement, strategic alignment, and Iraq is one of those places. But there are, of course, other regions where, you know, it's much more conflictual. And that's, of course, Yemen, where there's a clash in interest. And, of course, Syria, which, you know, has become basically a battlefield for various factions in a very complicated and very convoluted sort of balance of power and sort of conflicts in the Middle East, which, you know, unlike in the Cold War, there's no nice and easy, steady lines between the two sides as well. So we have a very complicated proxy war taking place in Syria, in which Iran is a huge player. And, you know, by leaving the Iran nuclear deal, it just makes sort of a general resolution to these issues a lot more difficult.
So, and guys, can we get this clip up of Netanyahu talking about war? I think it is on the list. But we have this meeting in Warsaw taking place, and it is interesting. I mean, there's a lot of hype about supposed differences between the Europeans and Trump, and, you know, clearly, obviously, you know, people like Macron and Angela Merkel are on a different, you know, different page than Donald Trump or Benjamin Netanyahu, for that matter, in terms of, you know, wanting a different, you know, preserving the basically kind of post-World War II order with its own obvious sets of huge, massive problems, inequities, abuses, and contradictions. That's different than this sort of reordering of global institutions. I wouldn't call it necessarily nationalism. I actually think all of this resurgent far-right forces are quite globally oriented, as evidenced by even this. But, you know, they're not at this conference. But you do see certainly Gulf foreign ministers, and so that this kind of alliance that everybody's known about between Israel and the Gulf is kind of coming out more overtly here, and the Europeans are sending low-level officials and have a kind of problem with the fundamental premise of what certainly looks like a push for war conference. And I want to play, this was Benjamin Netanyahu yesterday in Warsaw. My understanding is they've since tried to kind of on different clips they're releasing now, they've put a different English translation from, but the word in Hebrew means war. Let's look at Netanyahu from yesterday.
מכאן אני הולך למפגש עם 60 שרי חוץ ונציגים של מדינות בעולם נגד איראן. מה שקשור? זה מפגש.
We obviously need one with English subtitles. Okay. The bottom line is, maybe we'll get to one later, but Benjamin Netanyahu talked about moving the world together, including Arab states, and the word he used was war with Iran. I mean, that's horrifying. That's obviously a game-changing global catastrophe if they actually go forward with this. Mike Pompeo's there saying that no peace in the Middle East. Vice President Pence is there trying to chastise the Europeans for trying to save the Iran deal achievement. How scared should we be?
Well, it does have a very retro feeling. If you remember the coalition of the willing just before the Iraq war, mm-hmm. You know, you see the United States trying to weld together an alliance in the face of opposition from, you know, some of its main allies in Europe. You know, the reason the conference is taking place in Poland is because, you know, Poland has a right wing government that is sort of very is close to Trump ideologically, but also kind of wants to be in Trump's good books because they fear Russian aggression. They fear, you know, Trump's relationship with Russia. I think they've even asked for a new military base to be built in Poland, and they promised to call it Camp Trump, trying to appeal to him. But
that sounds like an amazing idea.
Well, I'm sure it's probably the best strategy if you want a new military base in your country. Right. So this Warsaw meeting was sort of announced in the Cairo speech Mike Pompeo gave last month. And, you know, it was initially supposed to be this meeting on Iran, although since then there's been sort of an expansion. You have, you know, talk about the Israeli-Palestinian Jared's peace plan coming out. There's going to be discussions on Syria, okay. discussions on Yemen. And, you know, Pompeo is touting the fact that some 60 nations from all the continents in the world are there. Of course, many of the major players aren't there. You know, we have Israel, Saudi Arabia, the U.S., the Gulf countries there, like Oman and the UAE. But we don't have any high we don't have the EU top diplomat. The Lebanese aren't there. The Palestinians are there. Jeremy Hunt, the British foreign minister, is there, but he's only there to talk about Yemen. So sort of this plan, this sort of Walsall was an attempt to sort of build this coalition against Iran, but to get, you know, to stop it from sort of falling through in its entirety, I think they've agreed, the Americans agreed to put a few more topics on the agenda. So now we have, you know, Bibi's statements about war with Iran. Now, you know, I'm not an expert in the Hebrew language, whether this was a mistranslation or
to be clear, Gene, I mean, most people I've looked at have who know this well have definitely said that is the correct translation. But I think the most clarifying is that if I recall correctly, the first tweet out of this was from the official prime ministerial account of Israel, and that was their translation.
Yes, I think there's been some sort of press about this. I was reading and reading different accounts, but I think the you know, we can miss the forest for the trees, because of course the fact is that in such a tense circumstances as we have existing between Israel and Iran, you know, any slight slip of the tongue, even if it's intended or it's unintended, you know, is an extremely dangerous thing. It just shows how, you know, the fact that these words reverberated around the world so quickly sort of demonstrate, you know, how tense relations are. And if we look over the last year and a half, you know, there have been several clashes between the Iranians and the Israelis in Syria. And these weren't clashes between proxy groups. You know, you have a Iranian drone going towards the Israelis. Israeli attacks back on sort of in Syrian air defenses and Iranian bases in early 2018. And, you know, the Russians had to intervene to de-escalate that conflict. Again, when Trump withdrew from the Iran deal in May, this was almost immediately followed by Iranian rockets and Israeli strikes in Syria. So we've been seeing this escalation and ongoing sort of conflict between the Israelis and the Iranians. There's obviously limits to it. This is not an all-out war, but you know, this is definitely, you know, a conflict that's taking place, and there are military forces involved. So, you know,
let's actually play that clip. We have it because there's another part of it that I want to ask you about. This is with translation of Netanyahu from yesterday. We just came from an excellent meeting with Oman's minister responsible for foreign affairs. That's what he's saying. We discussed additional steps we can take together with countries of the region in order to advance common interests. That will continue. From here, I'm going to a meeting with 60 foreign ministers and envoys from countries around the world against Iran. What is important about this meeting is not in secret, because there are many of those, is that there's an open meeting with representatives of leading Arab countries, and they're sitting down together with Israel in order to advance the common interest of war with Iran. All right. I mean, look, I will editorialize. I think we should be enormously concerned by this. And I think the push is rather obvious coming out of these three centers, the U.S., Israeli, and the Gulf. But the thing that I'm confused about there is my understanding from the Obama process that led to the Iran deal was that actually Oman was a interlocutor and helped pave the way for that deal. So I'm surprised, unless Netanyahu could just be misrepresenting what he and the Omanis talked, the tone of the Omanis. But is there a shift in Oman here?
Well, Oman has a long history of relations with complicated relations with Iran. The Shah, for example, sent troops to Oman in the 70s to help the Omani monarchy against left-wing insurgents. And of course, there are religious ties between Oman and Iran, Oman is a it's a different sect of Shiism, but it's a Shia dominated country. So there are connections. So yes, Oman has sort of had better relations with Iran over the years, but I think what we're seeing in the Gulf is a consolidation of, we have the main power, Saudi Arabia, having an increasingly hostile stance towards Iran. So, that's forcing other Gulf countries, smaller Gulf countries, to, have to make a choice between, what they're going to do. I mean, the Saudis are more than willing to intervene in their neighbors. It's not only in Yemen that the Saudis are intervening, but we've seen them, intervene in other parts of the Gulf as well, militarily, as well as around the region with their money and their support and so on and so forth. We've seen them bullying the Lebanese prime minister. They basically abducted him. So, people are playing for keeps in the Middle East. And so I think what we're seeing is, coalitions forming. And I agree with you, this kind of language is extremely destabilizing to the region with, we have violence taking place. I mean, I believe in January the Israelis were striking Iranian forces in Syria, and I'm sure we don't hear on the sort of public news all the operations that are taking place. And we can add to this, Saudi Arabia, of course, is increasingly concerned about the growth of Iranian power. Historically, Saudi Arabia supported a strong Iraqi regime. They supported Saddam Hussein during the 1980s as a bulwark against Iranian expansion. But now Iraq is basically a far more, friendly country to the Iranians. So, Saudi Arabia is looking for strong allies in this front as well. This rapprochement between Saudi Arabia and Israel is sort of born out of a mutual dislike and antagonism towards Iran. And, nobody knows how far this is going to escalate. As we've seen, it can escalate to a disastrous level. And, even if we don't see an all-out war with Iran, it looks like the American government and perhaps also the Israelis and the Saudis are attempting to, force the Iranian regime to at least implode. And what's dangerous about that is that we might end up with a Syria-like situation in Iran, which is going to be even more devastating and destabilizing for the region. Syria has been an enormously destabilizing factor, not only in the Middle East, but in Europe, with these huge waves of refugees and the ability of politically right-wing forces in Europe to sort of mobilize those things. So a war with Iran and, perhaps a fresh wave of refugees, of Iranians fleeing the country could be further destabilizing. So, this...
And just humanitarianly catastrophic. I just want to say really quickly too, because we'll pivot the last couple of minutes to Kurdistan and Kurdish political prisoners in Turkey that we've written about. But I think that it's very important, especially if you just look at Netanyahu specifically. Netanyahu has used Iraq and Iran have always been his main framing devices for supporting the unending occupation of Palestine and the lack of Palestinian rights and, all of the abuses in Gaza and so on. And, it's both in some ways, it's such a lazy framing device and a sort of endless excuse that one almost wonders if they would even want to get rid of Iran as a reason for, because that's the kind of always the fallback. And again, this is not just, critics like me. I mean, people like in the Israeli security establishment, Ehud Olmert, as an example, have called out the delusional fear-mongering about Iran and have kind of acknowledged that it's a distraction from Israel, having an apartheid state. But I think, I will say that very specifically, when you correlate the language of that 2002 clip on Iraq and you look at Mike Pompeo, who is also, an extraordinarily dangerous and extremist figure in foreign policy making, I think that we need to. I think you're right, and I'm not a doomsday person. And as horrifying and as catastrophic and as terrible and as disastrous as this administration will always be, there was some catastrophe scenarios that I didn't really see in the same way, or even things like the Russia thing doesn't cause me, various conniptions it seems to cause people. But I've always thought that there is a serious contingent here in that far right axis emanating from, you know, the Emiratis to Tel Aviv to D.C. that might want to do something incredibly reckless and dangerous here with Iran. And I just think we need to be, you know, incredibly focused on this and aware of it, because it could not be more dangerous in either of the scenarios that you outlined. And by the way, including even just this present scenario.
Let me just add one thing
to
that.
Sure.
I mean, I think a key figure that we have to mention is John Bolton. And, the fact that, I think last week Bolton was caught having on his pad that he was moving troops to Venezuela. He's a well-known war hawk. And it's not so long ago, 2015, that he was, writing op-eds calling on the United States to bomb Iran. Earlier this year, there were reports that, there were plans drawn up to strike Iran. So, even if we're not going to see this full-scale invasion, strikes on Iran are going to bring about a response. And Iran, one of the key areas of difference between Iran and the West is over Iran's ballistic missile program. Mm-hmm. And Iran, in 2017 was able to fire missiles from its territory to hit rebel targets in Syria. So, Iran has a growing missile capability. So it's not as if, Iran is incapable of striking back. These things could get out of hand before people even realize that they've gotten out of hand.
Right. Let's touch briefly on a couple things with Kurdistan before you go. First of all, you and I did coverage several weeks ago when the first pullout plan from Syria was announced. I support pulling most forces out, but I do not want to sell out the Syrian Kurds to Turkey. And I look at politics through the prism of power. And as I've said a million times, even as I'm a robust critic of Russian and Chinese, zones of influence and abuses, just as I am, of course, of the United States. But if Russia was able to play a role in Venezuela that helped stop a coup process there, that would be great. And if U.S. forces are supporting, of course, not for the right reasons, I think we can move beyond those kind of childish conversations, but because of strategic calculation, a very noble and important political experiment and an expression of people who have been long repressed internally in the Middle East, as well as blocking a Turkish ethnic cleansing campaign, then I certainly support maintaining those troop levels. And I know you're on the same page with me. Where are we at with that first? What's the state?
Well, I might first begin by saying there is a kind of through line to this with this issue with Israel and Iran at the moment. One of the reasons things are sort of becoming more tense between Israel and Iran is the U.S. is withdrawing from Syria, and the Israelis are very concerned that this will be a victory for the Iranians. So that's a kind of side point in how these things all link together. But in general, since we had the announcement towards the end of December by Trump, sort of surprising everybody that there was an agreement to withdraw troops. This made Turkey very happy, and it was also announced at the same time as a military deal with the Turks for the Patriot missile system and for some fighter jets as well. So what it looked like at the end of December was sort of a replay of what had happened in the 1970s. The United States had backed Kurdish guerrillas, but as soon as they managed to sort of sort out their bigger issues, the Kurds were dumped and sort of left to the hands of their enemies, in that case, the Iraqis. And this time it looked as if, the Americans were about to declare victory over ISIS, pack up and go home and leave the Syrian Kurds at the tender mercies of the Turkish military. And, just as the Americans were announcing they were leaving, you had Turkish officials promising that the Kurds in Syria would be sort of unceremoniously executed and dumped in ditches and buried in their ditches. So very inflammatory language. And apparently that's one of the reasons that General Mattis sort of resigned he was kind of felt he was being made a fool of, because, he'd promised these people one thing and now they were going to be left to the mercy of the Turks. Now, what has happened since then has been utter confusion. So we've had the sort of, you know, it's painfully obvious that ISIS hasn't been, you know, defeated. As Trump was making the announcement, there was, you know, still fighting going on. There's still fighting taking place. But certainly we are coming to the end phase of the ISIS campaign, or at least defeating the territorial caliphate. So, you know, we're beginning to talk about, what are we going to do with all these foreign fighters? What are the Syrian Kurds going to do? Are they going to send them back to America or to Britain or France, wherever they come from, and so on and so forth? So that conflict is certainly coming to an end, but you know, there doesn't seem to be any appetite amongst the military to be withdrawing so quickly, especially, you know, with the idea that, you know, ISIS could reemerge. You know, you have the sort of more hawkish elements within the foreign policy establishment. You have people like Bolton and Pompeo, who seem to be trying to navigate between making Turkey happy, who wants a U.S. withdrawal and wants to be able to move in to Syria to force the Syrian Kurds out of the areas that they control, because, of course, Turkey regards the Syrian Kurdish forces, the Syrian Democratic Forces and the YPG, as being an extension of the PKK, which is the insurgency organization that is operating within Turkey. Now, what's happened now is we have America saying, on one hand, it's going to defend the Kurds. And in a, you know, in a tweet, Trump even threatened economic war with Turkey if they attack the Kurds. But at the same time, the United States is offering Turkey a safe zone, saying that, OK, you can have some kind of safe deployment zone. Now, this makes no sense, because if you know the geography of Syria, you'll know most of the Syrian Kurdish areas are within 10, 20 kilometers of the Turkish border. So the creation of a Turkish-dominated safe zone would mean almost the entire occupation of the Kurdish areas of Syria. So we have these sort of two different tracks taking place. Bolton, for example, traveled to Ankara, and apparently his promise to protect the Syrian Kurds enraged Erdogan so much that he refused to meet with him. Mm-hmm. Then you had Lindsey Graham, who has been critical of Turkey, sort of going to Turkey and talking with the Turkish government. And you sort of have this weird position where America says, okay, we recognize the PKK are terrorists, but the YPG and the Syrian Kurds aren't terrorists. They aren't the PKK, when, you know, there is certainly a crossover between PKK membership and YPG membership. So there's a kind of willful self-delusion. So again, nobody knows what's going on. There were senior Syrian Kurdish officials came to Washington, Ilham Ahmed, who was representing the Syrian Kurds, you know, spoke to Trump, and Trump apparently said that he loved the Kurds. So nobody knows what's going on. People on the ground are very skeptical now that the U.S. will withdraw, and more so since Congress has acted. Recently, Congress, there was a bipartisan resolution put forward by Marsha Blackburn and Tammy Duckworth calling on Trump to sort of prevent a war between Turkey and the Syrian Kurds, because the Syrian Kurds have fought alongside the U.S. Against the Islamic State. And on a side note, the reason Marsha Blackburn is perhaps most interested in that is because Nashville, Tennessee is home to the largest Kurdish community in North America. So there's a kind of bit of local politics involved.
Well, so Marsha Blackburn, one of the worst people in Congress, who is mainly there to help people's student loans destroy their lives and defend home state HMOs, I guess at least credit due. There's a little bit of her constituent services are finally benefiting a worthy group. Literally 2 minutes left, but I do want to talk about this. You and I wrote a piece for the Jacobin a couple of weeks ago where we talked about the leadership of the HDP, which is a democratic, in fact, social democratic party in Turkey. They've been imprisoned by Erdogan as the just, you know, what has always been an authoritarian leaning leader has just, you know, he's fully emerged. And in some ways you can understand Erdogan, I guess, along with Putin would be an early, like, these are the kind of early prototypes of the far right authoritarians, you know, the Trumps, the Modis, the Bolsonaros, the Arbans, the Dutertes that we see across the globe. And so, you know, we would oppose and speak out for as many people who've been imprisoned as possible, of course. And I speak a lot about Lula, But there is something, the reason we wrote this piece is not only is the imprisonment of these leaders of the HDP completely, you know, comically unjustified and abusive in and of itself, they actually represent a political tendency which is not only an enormous promise for Turkey, but actually holds a different key to politics, potentially in the Middle East.
Yeah, I mean, I think, well, the latest with that, of course, the imprisonment still is still going on. And in fact,
and who are the names? I forgot. Like, who are the names of these guys?
Yeah, the leaders, Saladin Demirtas and Figen Yüksekdağ, who are the co-leaders of the HDP. The HDP is a political party and organization in which the major executive positions are split into co-leaders, which can either be a man and a woman or two women. So it's a way of kind of ensuring women have a greater role in politics, which is a remarkably progressive in the Middle Eastern context. And what sort of singles it out in terms of sort of women's rights and the women's issue, many sort of reforms that are orientated towards liberating women are top down into, you know, forcing people to take off their headscarves and so on and so forth. Mm. But this is actually a bottom up sort of form of women's liberation in which women are actually participating and are not being given rights from the top down. But sort of I stray from the point there in that, you know, yes, we're continuing to see a persecution of the HDP in Turkey at the moment. Local elections are coming up very soon in Turkey next month. So Erdogan is obviously trying to harden up his nationalist base. His tough rhetoric against the Kurds in Syria is part of it, and his tough rhetoric against the Kurds inside Turkey or Kurdish political parties inside Turkey are part of this. So we're seeing basically Erdogan recently made a statement saying there's no difference between the HDP, the PKK, the YPG. They're all part of the same network. And, you know, we're seeing ongoing imprisonment of HDP officials from the level of parliamentary deputy right down to local government officials. Now, of course, there are protests taking place. For example, Leyla Güven, who is a HDP deputy, is on hunger strike, and she's protesting the continued isolation of the PKK's leader, Abdullah Öcalan. And sort of the reason for doing this is that, you know, in the past, the Justice and Development Party, Erdogan's political party, had been engaged in a peace process with the PKK. At the end of the day, you need to make peace with the parties that you're fighting with. And this has come to an end. So her protest is sort of, you know, some people are trying to paint it as being sort of very much part of this Abdullah Öcalan cult of personality, this sort of being pro-PKK, but rather it's kind of call for the two sides to get back together and restart these peace talks as well. So protests are continuing, but the suppression of the sort of parliamentary wing of this social democratic movement, which brings together Kurds, LGBT people, environmentalists, labor activists, left-wing activists, all these groups together, you know, this repression is particularly strong. And Erdogan, as a prototype of one of these right-wing authoritarian leaders, you know, one has to sort of not underestimate him. You know, he is a very successful leader who has a very good, you know, feeling for Turkish politics, who's managed himself, managed control, you know, very well in the country. But at the same time, we're beginning to see conflicts taking place in Turkey. Turkey is also suffering from mismanagement because of the increasingly authoritarian nature of the Erdogan government. We have massive inflation taking place in Turkey. Inflation has been a perennial problem in Turkey, but in recent years it has been kind of kept under control. But growing conflict between, you know, Turkey's sort of growing conflict in the region, Turkey's sort of increasingly problematic relations with the West are all beginning to sort of take their toll on the Turkish economy. So nationalism, of course, is always a good way of sort of deflecting against these problems. Erdogan recently made a speech and said, told people to stop complaining about the price of staples and start worrying about how much bullets cost and how much soldiers' uniforms cost, because Turkey is under threat. So Turkey has this very strange
and also
position.
Terrorizing a bad Nix center too.
Is he a bad center?
He's not great, but there are bigger concerns. and protecting him. Dennis Cantor. Gene Bajelan, I really appreciate your time as always. Professor at Missouri State University. You can obviously find Gene's work so far in the book that's coming out is of the well-written but serious academic variety. You can also see him and hear him on TMBS with both Main Show and, of course, Illicit Histories. Gene, I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much, Michael. You take care of yourself.
Thanks, brother. All right, folks. Another banger. We're going to go to the fun half where we'll take your calls and IMs. We got to do a bit of a, actually, TMBS-style illicit history of Guatemala and El Salvador, because the only good thing about Elliot Abrams, well, I mean, first was watching Ilhan Omar kick his ass, and the contrast of, like, you know, a noble, promising young progressive leader versus just, like, this grotesque, hideous old ghoul was very satisfying. But it's worth digging into the history of, you know, crimes that he and the Reagan administration were an intimate part of. And also, you know, the fact that this twerp complex in Washington's big response is not to go, oh, shit, maybe we should, you know, at least put out a report on the support of the Reagan administration for what is literally an internationally recognized genocide in Guatemala in the 1980s. No, it's don't be rude to Elliot Abrams. I'm a big critic, as I keep saying, of all sorts of internet toxicity. There's an essay called Exiting the Vampire Castle that I would recommend people read if you're interested in that. But if there is a place where, you know, this is a good example where Elliot Abrams, yes, be much more patient with your fellow humans in general and realize.
Don't cancel Elliot Abrams.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Exactly. I will say we are two away from our first 2,000 TMBS feature. Oh, wait. Well, first of all, sorry, before I get to that, become a member of the Majority Report today. Less than pennies a day gets you jam-packed content. We were just recording just before. I mean, next week we're on vacation, but you're going to get four new excellent interviews and then some incredible work from the MRI archives back in the MR days. And some of these interviews, particularly Bill Ozonek on stock buybacks and the one, another excellent piece of intellectual history debunking the IQ and race trash that, you know, happily Sam Harris drearily, and I, of course, I mean happily, not literally, Sam Harris drearily resuscitated for a whole bunch of new people. Thank you so much. A great intellectual history there debunking and really discovering the origins of that dangerous garbage. So you maintain independent media. You maintain everything that we do unbought, unbossed by becoming a member of the Majority Report today, supporting justcoffee.coop, subscribing on YouTube, and, you know, all the rest of it. TMBS is two patrons away from our first 2,000 patrons. So go there. We're doing a tremendous amount of work. This weekend, Illicit History of Why the 1970s Post-Colonial Nationalist Movements and Global Effort to Reorder the Global Economy Failed, and the Michael Manley Experiment in Jamaica with Professor Adam Chetichu. She's has a new great book out and teaches at the University of Chicago. Mark Blythe was on yesterday. We're doing a special show on Friday because we're off next week. We're going to be fun, and Big Waz is going to call in. Now, there's a link on the Majority, and so patreon.com/TMBS, patreon.com/TMBS. Also, go and subscribe to the Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. April 20th, we packed the Bell House, and now it's time for us to pack the Bootleg Theater in L.A. Incredibly excited about the second Michael Brooks Show live show. Tickets are available now. If they continue selling at the rate that they have in the first day they've been up with very little promotion, we're going to be sold out like in a matter of weeks. And this is even before Anna Kasparian, who's going to be one of our esteemed guests, starts hyping it on TYT. So get your tickets quickly, click on the link, and come see Left is Best West Coast Fest with the fellas from TMBS crew and our great guests, Wozni Lombre, Big Woz, Anna Kasparian, and Nando Vila. Matt.
Literary Hangover on Saturday coming is The Unparalleled Adventures of One Hans Fall, which is about a guy who reacts to his artisanal industry, which is a bellows mender, which a bellows is how you would blow air into fireplaces. That gets taken away by capitalism. The artisanal system gets taken away. So he decides to blow up his creditors and go to the moon in a hot air balloon. And it's early sci-fi, so...
Wanted to give that character a little fanfare.
And we do the entire short story. It's an hour and 40 minutes. The whole episode is going to be like in the, it's going to be in the Dan Carlin, Joe Rogan length of podcast. It's going to be up like 3 hours and 40 minutes, but that'll be out on Saturday.
Sounds great. It reminds me of, because we were talking about how, you know, like Rush Limbaugh's bumper music is actually like a really good song. And it's about basically like Ohio being ruined by strip malls, and it sort of, I mean, to the extent that the song does have politics and it has some, it's like completely antithetical to Rush Limbaugh. But I was just thinking of that short story in relationship to Ohio by the Pretenders. And of course, big announcement, Brendan Finn's Jerry's Dead, Fish Sucks, Get a Job podcast has been launched. All right, folks, we'll see you on the fun half. Oh, we will see you on the fun half. We'll see you on the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Who sent us this?